It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Adoptions can be very complicated, and sometimes folks don't realize that. We sometimes get calls at the office where somebody will call and say that there's a friend of a friend whose baby they want to adopt, and can they just come in and sign whatever forms need to be signed? Many people do not understand that in most adoptions, they are going to need what's called a home study and go through a home study process.
Private attorney Colleen Quinn talks about adoption and surrogacy and the laws governing how new families are built. And during this week's question and answer session, we discuss bedbugs and explain why landlords and not tenants are responsible for eradicating the problem and paying the costs. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 139, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Is Representative Eric Cantor afraid to talk to his constituents? Virginia Organizing thinks so, and says that hurricanes and earthquakes aside, the biggest disaster is his unwillingness to work on creating jobs. Despite a continuing job crisis, Representative Cantor avoided talking about jobs in his district by not holding public events or town halls over the entire congressional August recess period. On August 31, over 200 Virginia Organizing members gathered outside of Representative Cantor's so-called town hall in Richmond to make their voices heard on the need for jobs and hurricane disaster funding with no strings attached. In the wake of Hurricane Irene, Representative Cantor flatly stated there would be no disaster relief without spending cuts. According to Virginia Organizing, we have really reached a new low in American politics if Representative Cantor is willing to use disaster relief as a political bargaining chip. We are the richest nation in the world and should be able to respond to disasters with more dignity than someone bartering for a couch on Craigslist. Virginia Organizing ended up rallying across the street while Cantor noted to the audience inside that he was happy that the protesters were kept out. Virginia Organizing promises to keep the pressure on, so Representative Cantor has to hear from all of his constituents. In other news, last month, the Virginia Interfaith Center announced the group's strong support for maintaining the state's long-running ban on uranium mining. The nearly 30-year-old ban protects Virginians from the harmful effects uranium mining poses to our health, drinking water, and Virginia's economy. Foreign-backed companies are working to remove the ban to exploit a uranium deposit in Pennsylvania County. The proposed uranium mine and processing site could put drinking water for over a million Virginians, including in Chesapeake, Virginia Beach, and Halifax County, at risk. This water supplies the local agricultural and tourism businesses, as well as one of Virginia's major economic hubs, Hampton Roads. Uranium mining also endangers the physical health of families and would create a legacy of toxic waste for future generations of Virginians. The Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy is a member of the statewide Keep the Ban Coalition and is Virginia's oldest faith-based advocacy group, a nonpartisan coalition of faith communities working to create progressive public policy by engaging people of faith, educating the public about social issues, the legislative process, and the call to advocacy. For more information, go to http://keeptheban.org. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You are listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Richmond Tenants Organization versus Kemp. In 1990, the Richmond Tenants Organization sued the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, seeking a declaration that the seizures of the homes of public housing tenants without prior notice and a hearing, and the summary evictions of those tenants under the National Public Housing Asset Forfeiture Project were unlawful. Both the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit agreed and permanently enjoined any evictions without notice and a hearing. The courts held that in the absence of a true emergency situation, the Due Process Clause of the Constitution required the government to provide notice and an opportunity to be heard before a tenant could be evicted. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
It's time for this week's question and answer session. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Would you please tell us your name and where you're from?
Ken from Richmond, Virginia.
Welcome to the show. Ken, what question do we have this week?
I want to know if I'm responsible for payment of bed bug treatment, which I did not create.
Well, Ken, we get that question a lot. And the answer is absolutely not. You are not responsible for the cost of bedbug treatment, and indeed, there is no legal authority that allows a landlord to require a tenant to pay for the cost of bedbug treatment. The reason I'm so confident in saying this is back in March, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development studied the whole bedbug problem very carefully. They issued a 7-page memo. It says that bedbugs can be introduced to a property simply by hitchhiking on clothing and can be introduced by the landlord themselves or their employees or maintenance personnel or contractors or vendors or government representatives or really anyone who has had access to the property. No one's immune from transporting bed bugs. They are not linked to poor sanitation or poor housekeeping, and the conclusion of HUD is that it is virtually impossible to prove fault with regard to who may have created the bed bug infestation within a property. What they conclude from that is that residents should not bear the burden regarding the introduction of bedbugs to a property, and that landlords should be reasonable and should not penalize tenants because they have discovered and reported bedbugs within their unit. What landlords should do is when tenants report they have bedbugs, the landlord should inspect, confirm that the pest is a bedbug, and if so, immediately treat not only that unit, but all of the surrounding units. Because it's not normally considered an emergency, the tenants should receive at least a 2-day notice before inspection and treatment, and only if advised by a qualified pest control professional should landlords notify tenants that they should dispose of furnishings. And this should only be done as a last resort, not as a first resort. Finally, HUD concludes that bedbug infestation is not grounds for termination of tenancy. In other words, it's not the tenant's fault. The Virginia Residential Landlord-Tenant Act makes it clear that routine maintenance and repairs and keeping the place habitable is the responsibility of the landlord. It is not the responsibility of the tenant. And even if the tenant has signed something saying otherwise, like a bedbug addendum, that is not enforceable because the law says a tenant cannot waive or give up or forego any rights or remedies under the Virginia Residential Landlord-Tenant Act. So tenants should not sit by idly and do nothing. They should write back their landlord and say they deny responsibility for payment. They should make their regular other payments, but say that that money should not be applied to the bed bug cost. And if they're sued about the bed bug cost, whether it's for money or for possession or both, they should immediately get legal help. Is this helpful to you?
Yes, it is. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being on the show. We're here in the near west end of Henrico County, and we're speaking with Colleen Quinn. She runs the Adoption and Surrogacy Law Center at Lock, Parton, DeBoer, and Quinn, and we will be talking about adoption today. Welcome to the show, Colleen.
Thank you very much, Martin.
Now, I understand there was recently a surrogacy ring that was busted, and that makes a very interesting lead-in to this area of law. Would you tell us about that?
Absolutely. Adoption can be a very complicated and risky area of the law. You have many, many potential adoptive parents who are really quite desperate to have a child. Many have spent tens of thousands of dollars on infertility treatments and whatnot. And what happened with this baby selling ring was an attorney out in California named Teresa Erickson and another attorney in Maryland named Hillary Neiman basically were sending women to the Ukraine to be impregnated with donor egg and donor sperm. And basically, these women were what we call gestational carriers. And then they were bringing the women back to the United States and basically telling potential adoptive parents that they had a birth mother or they had birth mothers who had had an adoption plan, but the adoptive parents had backed out. And so they were proposing these potential birth mothers who were really gestational carriers as having children that they could basically purchase, and they were charging anywhere from about $100,000 to $180,000. It was the rock producer Howard Stein's daughter, Taylor Stein, who actually was contacted by Hillary Neiman, and in her case, she was told that the baby boy that she could get would be $180,000, and she obviously smelled something amuck and ended up cooperating with the FBI wearing a wire. And now these women and also one of the carriers who was a frequent carrier have all been indicted. And the two attorneys have pled guilty to basically wire fraud. It's interesting what crimes sometimes have to be used to stop illegalities such as this one.
So you've told us how this is not supposed to take place.
Exactly.
Tell us how it is supposed to take place.
Adoptions can be very complicated, and sometimes folks don't realize that. We sometimes get calls at the office where somebody will call and say that there's a friend of a friend whose baby they want to adopt, and can they just come in and sign whatever forms need to be signed? Many people do not understand that in most adoptions, they are going to need what's called a home study and go through a home study process. So unless it's like a step-parent adoption or an adult adoption or a relative adoption, and even the relative adoptions, if the relatives haven't had the child in their home for 3 years, folks are still going to need a home study. And this home study, you know, is where an agency comes in, and it's not quite the white glove test, you know, where they're checking to make sure that everything's super clean, but they're doing criminal background checks, child protective services checks, making sure that folks are medically cleared, that they're psychologically cleared, they're financially cleared. People that want to adopt really go through a lot more scrutiny than a biological parent would have.
Now, I gather that there are two basic different types of adoption. Would you tell us what those are, and then we'll sort of go through each type one by one?
Sure. When my clients get on the internet, or even when a placing parent gets on the internet and you plug in the word adoption, it is just incredibly overwhelming and confusing. So what I like to do is I try to kind of break the world of adoptions into two different ballparks. One is the agency adoption, and the other is what I call the parental placement adoption. And in a parental placement adoption, it, sometimes it's called a direct placement or an independent placement. It's basically, though, where the placing parents, the birth parents, we call them birth parents in Virginia because that's what's in our Virginia code. That's very politically incorrect. It should be an expectant parent with a placement plan. Birth parents in a parental placement basically place the child directly with the adopting parents. In an agency placement, the agency actually takes custody of the child. And without getting into too much legal detail, they take legal and physical custody and turn around and give temporary physical custody to the adoptive parents. And then some 3 to 6 months later, the agency actually consents to the adoption. So in a parental placement, you have a direct placing of the child, whereas in an agency placement, it's more of an indirect placing.
Now, in the parental placement adoption, I gather this works not only for newborns, but also for children who are being adopted at any age, like step-parent adoptions or relative adoptions. What's that process like?
Well, each process is a little bit different. Your step-parent adoptions, you generally don't need a home study, and it is a parental placement. So one biological parent is signing off on new stepmom or new dad can become the legal dad or mom of that child. The step-parent adoptions tend to be a little bit less complicated. We see a lot of step-parent adoptions where the biological parent has essentially abandoned the child, and we have an abandonment statute that if they have not had any contact with the child for more than 6 months, then that adoption can proceed. Adult adoptions, you don't even need the consent of the biological parent.
And tell us what an adult adoption is.
It's usually when a relationship is formed. I just did one last week where it was the third cousin of the gentleman. Actually, it was his cousin once removed. So she was half his age. She had lost her mom and her dad some time ago. And so he was kind of like what you would consider almost a distant uncle type person. And he basically had been taking care of her for some time. And she's at age 20. Said, hey, I want him to be my dad. I don't have my biological parents around anymore. And so she and he agreed that he would adopt her, he being in his 40s, her 20 years old. But essentially, they had a father-daughter type relationship. It just wasn't a legal one until we did the adult adoption.
Okay, and what about same-sex adoption? That is, where a same-sex couple wants to adopt. Is that allowed in Virginia, or are there workarounds for that?
There are some workarounds, Martin. In Virginia, we still tend to be a pretty conservative state. And so we in Virginia at this time cannot do second parent adoptions is what we call them, or same-sex adoptions. However, we can get pretty close. I've been doing a lot of joint custody co-guardianship orders and have been getting more and more courts to enter those so that the non-adoptive parent or the non-biological parent in the same-sex couple can at least become a custodian and legal guardian for that child. And then we also have them make sure they have their trust and estate documents and their medical power of attorney, or the durable power of attorney, and their medical advance directive, that they have all those documents as well. And that's about as good as we can get in Virginia at this time.
What do you do in a situation where you have a contested adoption where one or perhaps both of the biological parents don't agree to the adoption? What's the process there?
Without getting too legal-easy, right now there's a Virginia Supreme Court opinion we're still waiting to come down called Todd versus Copeland, which is going to factor into what is the standard for a contested adoption. Is it just the best interest standard, or do we have to show that the continued relationship with the biological parent is actually detrimental to the child? And that's about as legal-easy as I'm going to get on that. The bottom line, Martin, is if we can get the biological parent that's objecting to the adoption to agree to an ongoing contact arrangement, then you kind of have the best of all worlds, because many times that biological parent doesn't have the financial ability to parent, really is objecting sometimes just because they don't want to lose contact with the child. But if they have an ongoing contact agreement, which can be anything from the exchange of just pictures and letters to actually coming and seeing and visiting with the child, then they can get, in some ways, the best of all worlds. They don't have a child support obligation, but they still get the visitation via the ongoing contact agreement.
And is that what we commonly refer to as a, quote, open adoption?
The term open adoption can be really confusing, because What used to be called closed adoptions just simply meant that the birth parents never met the adoptive parents. That in the traditional closed adoption, it was like when the 14-year-old girl was whisked away to another town to live with a distant aunt to place her child with Catholic charities. And the child would be placed with, you know, Catholic charities, and the girl who gave birth wouldn't have any idea where the child went, and she would, of course, return home, and things would resume, and there was a lot of secrecy, and that was the traditional closed adoption, where she had no idea who the adoptive parents were. So an open adoption can simply mean that the expectant parent knows who the adoptive parents are. Or an open adoption can also mean that there is ongoing contact in the relationship. So that term gets loosely used and tossed around and can sometimes be a little bit confusing.
Now, I know that another way that new families get formed is through what we call, I guess, assisted reproduction or surrogacy.
Right.
That's very complicated, but can you try to simplify it for our audience? What does that mean? How does that work?
Basically, finding somebody to carry the child for you. And that does not always mean that it's somebody that's getting compensated or getting reimbursed, you know, living expenses. We see a lot of carriers who are best friends, who are sisters-in-law. I even had the hairdresser who listened to the client for 4 years, you know, every time she did her hair, talk about how she so much wanted a child and she couldn't have one, and she was, you know, had miscarriages, and the hairdresser finally said, fine, I'll carry the child for you. So it really is a absolutely amazing field. I had over Christmas time, I had some film students film some of my carriers who were sisters that had carried for sisters, and their stories of why they had carried for their sisters were really uplifting and encouraging.
So is this all laid out in advance in some sort of a document that the carrier is going to do this and the adopting parent is going to do something else, and does money change hands, and if so, is that okay?
Well, they're two very different things, because with a surrogacy, the gestational, you typically have a contract, and the gestational carrier, unless it's a best friend or sister or relative type situation, is going to receive some sort of reimbursement for household living expenses, and usually over the course of the whole pregnancy in Virginia is going to be paid somewhere between about $18,000 to $25,000 for carrying the child. In an adoption, on the other hand, you can't pay the birth mom anything in Virginia unless she has a doctor's note saying she can't work. And in that situation, you could pay for her household type living expenses. So they're two very different creatures in terms of what payments are allowable.
Well, I can certainly see why this is not do-it-yourself law at all. It really does require an expert.
It does, Martin. And there are a lot of traps for the unwary in both areas. I have seen folks try to do home insemination without having a contract in place and then try to come to me to get the parentage corrected. And they've just made a mess of things by not coming to a lawyer to begin with to make sure that they, you know, they did everything by the book. And it's amazing what sometimes folks will try to do on their own in terms of having children.
Well, people are desperate to form new families, and that's, I guess, an explanation for why they do this. We have been speaking with Colleen Quinn. She is an attorney who runs the Adoption and Surrogacy Law Center at the law firm of Lockparton, DeBoer & Quinn in the near west end of Henrico County. Thank you much for being on the show.
You are very welcome.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 26, which deals with fiduciaries. A fiduciary is someone like a guardian, trustee, executor, or administrator who manages the property of someone else. Code of Virginia Section 26-40 lists almost 30 different investments considered lawful and conclusively presumed to be prudent. One of them is stocks, bonds, and other securities of the Richmond Fredericksburg, and Potomac Railroad Company. This may not sound strange, except that in 1971, the railroad divested its passenger service to Amtrak, and in 1991, divested its freight service to CSX Transportation. Nevertheless, it remains the law in Virginia that it is prudent to invest in a railroad company that no longer exists. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Our aging population means that most adults will need long-term care at some point during their lives. Join us next week when private attorney Sean Majette talks about the financial aspects of long-term care planning and the single most important thing you need to know. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.